ભગવતે વાસુદેવાય ઓમ નમો ભગવતે વાસુદેવાય Shabbatai Krishna Prasada Buddhale Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nityanamane Namaste Sarasvara Deva Gauravani Pracharane Nirvishesha Shanivari Pastratya Deshatarane Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sivasati Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama 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 Hare Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 23, verse 43. Nasam dvijati samskaro na nivaso gura api na tapo natma mimamsa na saucham na kriya Shubha Nasam Dujati Samskaro Nani Vaso Guravapi Natapo Natma Mimamsa Nasaucham Nakriya Subha Nasam Dujati Samskaro Nani vaso guravapi Natapo natma mimangsa Nasocham nakriya subha Na, there is not asam on their part Dvijati samskara Purification rituals Na nor nivasa, residence, guru, in the ashram of the spiritual master. Api, even, na, no, tapa, execution of austerities, na, no, atma mimamsa, philosophical inquiry, na, no, saucham, rituals of cleanliness. Na, no, kriya, ritualistic activities. Subha, pious. Translation, these women have never undergone the purificatory rites of the twice-born classes, nor have they lived as brahmacharis in the ashram of a spiritual master, nor have they executed austerities, speculated on the nature of the self, followed the formalities of cleanliness, or engaged in pious rituals. Nevertheless, they have firm devotion for Lord Krishna, whose glories are chanted by the exalted hymns of the Vedas, and who was the supreme master of all masters of mystic power. We, on the other hand, have no such devotion for the Lord, although we have executed all these processes. According to Srila Sridhar Swami, the husbands were not aware that their wives had occasionally associated with residents of Vrindavan, such as the flower ladies, and had heard about the beauty and qualities of Krishna. The Brahmanas were astonished at their wives' loving devotion for Lord Krishna, not realizing that this devotion had developed as a result of hearing and chanting about the Lord in the association of his pure devotees. Translation, these women have never undergone the purificatory rites of twice-born classes, nor have they lived as brahmacharis in the ashram of a spiritual master, nor have they executed austerities, speculated on the nature of the self, followed the formalities of cleanliness, or engaged in pious rituals. Nevertheless, they have firm devotion for Lord Krishna, whose glories are chanted by the exalted hymns of the Vedas, and who is the supreme master of all masters of mystic power. We, on the other hand, have had no such devotion for the Lord, although we have executed all these processes. So this statement is made by the unfortunate Brahmanas who did not give the food to Krishna and Balaram when the cowherd boys asked them for that food. So here we see that what the Brahmanas are stating is actually the conclusion, a very good conclusion about the process of bhakti. Though some people may misunderstand what bhakti is, here we find a very proper description. So in this very short statement, actually, they summarize the whole process of Vedic learning and cultivation, etc. We'll see in Bhagavad Gita and in Bhagavatam and in the other scriptures, there are many processes for developing spiritual life. And sometimes it becomes confusing because we will wonder which is the proper one to follow. So for instance, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna talks about Karma Yoga first and tells Arjuna to do that. Then he talks about Gyan Yoga and Astanga Yoga and finally Bhakti Yoga. So all of these things are there, but which one is everyone to follow? And even if people read Bhagavad Gita, many people still become very confused about this. And some will say that the essence of the Bhagavad Gita is Karma Yoga, even though Krishna makes it very clear at the end what the conclusion is. Similarly, in the Bhagavatam, we'll have descriptions of karma and of jnana also, particularly in the last part of the, let's say, chapter, canto, 11th canto, you'll find very extensive descriptions of jnana also. And to some extent, it's even Ashtanga Yoga, as mentioned. So, and if we look in other scriptures, these are very prominent. So the whole Karmakanda section of the Vedas is all about doing sacrifices and rituals, which the Brahmanas here were doing. If we look in the Vedas also, we'll see there is Gyankanda, the Upanishads, which are considered the essence of the Vedas or the main part of the Vedas. And what do they speak about? Mainly jnana. So these become very prominent, karma and jnana. So people are bound to become very confused. And if we go to India and we see the people who call themselves Hindus, followers of the scripture, then many will be karma yogis and many will be jnana yogis. the modern equivalents of that, not quite either actually, because they don't follow any of these processes properly. But they'll have some adherence to karma, do your duty, etc. Or jnana, let us all merge into Brahman. So these are very common. If you speak to people in India, they think they know something about spiritual life. They'll say, oh yes, I want to merge into the Brahman, or I'm doing my duty according to Krishna. I'm working very hard. So these are, of course, corruptions of the karma and jnana, but nevertheless, they're very popular with people. So this way we could say, well, why does Krishna confuse everybody by giving all these different processes? We have karma, jnana, yoga, bhakti. And of course here in Western world, yoga is very popular with everybody. They don't like bhakti or karma or jnana, but they do like yoga. So we have all these so-called Vedic processes there. So some people will say, oh, they're all very wonderful. You can do any of them and you get the same result. So, of course, in some one sense we can say it's true, in one sense it's false. It's not exactly that you do one process and you get the same result as another. But at the same time, they're all connected with each other. So we have to understand the intention with which the scriptures are written. And the intention is to direct people with different qualifications. And therefore, we have different processes for different types of people. But that doesn't mean they all get the same result. In other words, some processes are temporary processes. And the whole purpose of these different processes is to elevate a person to complete that process and go to something else. So once you're fully qualified and you execute, then you get a higher qualification. And then you must do something else. So that means that these processes are not the final end. If you complete karma, that doesn't mean you got perfection. What does it do? It qualifies you for the next step. So Prabhupada and Bhagavad Gita says it's like a ladder. You go up the ladder, do one process, to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, like that. So if you complete karma and varnashram and do all that very faithfully, follow your duties as a brahmana or a kshatriya or a vaishya or a sudra, and go through the ashramas, brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, sannyas, and do all that perfectly, then you become qualified by what? Sattva gun. Finally. After many, many lifetimes, of course. Because if you start out as sudra, you can't go to the top in one lifetime. It'll take many lifetimes. And finally, you become brahminical. And then you practice that brahminical life, and eventually you get renounced, and you take sannyas. So you reach a very high standard. Then you're qualified for what? Jnana. Meditate that you're not the material body, etc. Study the Upanishads solely. Forget about, reject karmakanda and all these duties, etc. Lead a life of renunciation, austerities, etc. And you meditate constantly. I'm not the body, I'm not the body. I am the Atma, I am the Brahman. And this is the process of jnana. And if you progress in that, then, as Krishna mentions in Bhagavad Gita, higher than that is yoga. And in that yoga process, one can more easily meditate. And what is the object of meditation? Not just Atma, but Paramatma. And with the aid of Paramatma, the mercy of Paramatma, then very easily you can realize Atma and Paramatma. So that is why it's considered easier, because we get the grace of the Lord to help us out in our realization of Atma. So therefore, the Ashtanga Yoga process is considered higher than the process of Jnana. So that's where we get our real realization of Atma and Paramatma. But as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, higher than that is Bhakti. Because not only we get realization of Atma and Paramatma, we also get realization of another form of the Lord, that is Bhagavan, in which we perform service to the Lord. So that's considered higher. All these processes are therefore steps only. We do karma, and eventually we get to jnana, we then get to yoga, and then we come to bhakti. So then people will say, I'm not qualified for bhakti, therefore I will go through these other processes. And that's true, one could do that. And normally that is what Krishna recommends to Arjuna. You're not qualified for jnana, therefore you do karma. However, the interesting thing about bhakti is that even though it's higher than the others, and one needs the highest qualification to come to bhakti after all the other processes, at the same time, bhakti does not depend upon these qualifications. You don't have to be a yogi or a jnani to perform bhakti. The other process is yes, and to do jnana, you have to have finished karma. You can't avoid that. You cannot be tamagun and do jnana or yoga. You have to complete the process and get up to sattva-gun. Then you can do jnana and karma, jnana and yoga. But you don't have to do that for bhakti. You don't have to be sattvic, you don't have to be a Brahman at all. Which is very mysterious, because everything else requires high qualification, and bhakti is the highest, but it requires low qualification. How's that? Looks like a contradiction. So that is why some people put bhakti at the bottom. Bhakti for all these sentimental people and women and people who have emotions. They're ignorant. Let the ignorant people do bhakti. Let them get purified, then they can do varnashram and jnana, etc. after that. I need to think like that. Of course, Krishna Bhagavad Gita says, okay, this process, everyone can do it. Striya Vaishnata Sudras Tepiyani Puram Gatim. And they get the perfection also. Everybody. So in one sense, it maybe looks like it is the lowest because everybody can do it. And you don't need a high qualification. But that is not so. Because Krishna does say that these are the bhaktas, they are most dear to me. They're the dearest to me. And of all the devotees, not the mixed devotees, the karma Mr. Bhaktas and the gyan Mr. Bhaktas, but the pure devotee, he is most dear to me. He is my very self. So we cannot say that bhakti is therefore less than anything else and low. But the power of bhakti is such that it surpasses all these types of qualification and is not caused by any of these conditions or the processes. It is completely independent. Why? It is transcendental. So it does not depend upon karma or jnana or yoga. It is independent. So it is superior because it is transcendental. In the 11th canto of Bhagavatam, there's a whole analysis of different things in Raja, Tama, and Sattva, and all those things like that. It mentions everything. And finally it says, but bhakti is superior. It's beyond the gunas. And everything related to bhakti is beyond the gunas. And the faith also in bhakti is beyond the gunas. So the qualification for bhakti is faith, and that faith is not rajas, tamas, or sattvic. It is not material. Even the faith to begin the process of bhakti is not belonging to the gunas. So Vishnu Chakravarti says even sadhana bhakti is transcendental to the gunas. It is beyond the gunas. Now, of course, we may not be on the gunas, be beyond the gunas, because we do have impurities and different desires, etc. But the process of bhakti that we practice is beyond the gunas. And is never affected by the material world. So, bhakti is superior to all of this. It is transcendental. But, because it is so powerful, it does not depend on any of these gunas, even for its qualification. But it does require that faith, something special, which may appear on any person in any guna. That transcendental faith may appear in anybody. Even if you're in tamaguna, transcendental faith may appear. And then you can practice. So this is one of the unique qualities of bhakti. It can appear anywhere in any human being. That because the faith can appear in anyone in spite of the gunas. So therefore we can never say that the gunas, especially sattva guna, is a cause of bhakti or a precondition. It is not. At the same time, it is favorable somewhat. Why? Because one has less sinful activities, one has less material desires, one has less attachment to material enjoyment. These are the qualities of sattva guna. One is satisfied in the self, not with material things. One is very peaceful. And of course, one of the qualities of sattva is prakasha, which means knowledge, which means not simply material knowledge, but it means that one can begin to distinguish between matter and spirit. So that's a good qualification for bhakti. Are a good condition for bhakti. But it's not absolutely necessary that you be in sattva guna. But it's favorable, we can say. So, though it is not a necessary condition, it also has some favorability towards it, bhakti also. So here the brahmanas are talking about all these different processes that their wives didn't do. They didn't do samskaras. Particularly the dvija samskar. In other words, they did not take upanayanam and get a thread and go to the gurukul. Because in general, the women didn't go. Only the men went of the higher castes. So they're saying our wives didn't get the upanayanam and therefore they didn't go to the ashram of the guru and study there and learn about the atma, atma mimamsa. They did not learn about the Upanishads. And learn how to distinguish body from soul, etc. They did not learn the proper rituals of cleanliness and how to perform sacrifices properly, kriya, subha, subha, kriya. the auspicious ceremonies, etc. They didn't learn all this. So they were, we could say, ignorant. They never learned the Vedas or any of the processes attached to the Vedas. So basically we have karmakanda, which means doing the sacrifices, following the rituals properly, being very pure, etc. And jnanakanda, living a very austere life, controlling the senses and understanding atma, atma mimamsa. So they didn't do either of these things because they didn't ever go to the Gurukul and they never ever took the Brahma Gayatri Diksha. So they're not twice born. They didn't get a second birth and start spiritual life even, according to the regular process of karma, that is, the Varnashram system. Still, they are superior to their husbands. And the husbands realize this. They got attraction to Krishna, and they gave everything up for Krishna. They were so detached from everything, they were even detached from their husbands, which is supposed to be the biggest attachment for the wife. So they gave up that attachment also. And they simply gave everything to Krishna. And they recognized Krishna as their master. So the brahmanas therefore say, our wives are greater than us, in spite of the fact they didn't go through this whole process into karma, again, yoga, whatever. They didn't do any of this. But they're in a much higher position. So in the purport, the explanation is given. Why? There's a reason for everything. It's not that things are haphazard in this world. So these women must have developed somehow or other, not just by luck or chance or whatever. And how was it? Because they had heard about Krishna from others. And so it says the flower sellers and other people had come and talked about Krishna and his wonderful form and his qualities and activities. And then these women heard about this from the flower sellers, etc. And then they became very, very attracted. So in other words, by association with those who have attraction for Krishna, one can also develop attraction for Krishna. Even though one has not gone through all the processes, even though one is not at the highest level of sattva or whatever. One can develop, in spite of not having the proper gunas to begin with. So that means that by association with devotees, then a person who's unqualified becomes qualified for bhakti and quickly develops. So somehow or other, we start with no qualification, but we end up with qualification. How is that? Because of association of devotees. So therefore, in the Bhagavatam, this association with devotees is often glorified in a very, very great way. Without the association of devotees, you cannot advance in spiritual life. You cannot advance in bhakti. Why? Because if there's any cause for bhakti, it is not karma, it is not jnana, it's not yoga, it's not the gunas, it's not sattva guna, not pious activities, not cleanliness, not austerity, not being a vegetarian, not any of these things. Association is the cause. That will be the main cause of bhakti. Everything else may lead you up to sattva guna or something like that, but sattva guna is not a cause of bhakti in itself. But association with devotees is a cause, no matter where you are in the material world and what position. So this is considered the main cause of bhakti. So we have, of course, adau, shraddha, tato, sadhu, sangata, bhajana, kriya, the steps in bhakti mentioned by Rupa Goswami. So first there is faith. But Vishnu Chakravarti says, but where does the faith come from? It just doesn't appear like that out of nowhere. So therefore he says, adau, which means in the beginning, or first there is faith. So he says, adau, before the faith, there is association with devotees. First there is association with devotees, adau. Then there is a shraddha. Then there is sadhu sangha again. So by the mercy of the devotees and that association, one develops faith. Even one is not consciously looking for that association. Somehow, by that association, one develops that faith. And then with that faith, one, using one's own intelligence, seeks out devotees. So this is what we call the causes, mercy of the devotees. without our asking or even seeking, they give up mercy to people in this material world by which they develop faith. Yeah? So in other words, there's no cause of bhakti in this world except the devotees. But we should not think that the devotees are independent of the Lord also. Rather, the devotee is empowered by the Lord. This is the Lord who has bhakti, and he gives that to the devotees, and the devotees gives out to the people in the material world. So therefore, the devotee is simply a representative of the Lord, and he distributes that mercy of Krishna everywhere. So the greatness of the devotee actually is the greatness of the Supreme Lord. Whatever power the devotee has to preach, it is the power of Krishna, manifested in the devotee because of his purity. So in this way, devotion exists in this material world because there are devotees. Of course, when Krishna comes as avatar, then he gives direct mercy, but he doesn't come all the time. So in between the appearances of the Lord, we have the devotees who give out the mercy. So this is the real cause of bhakti. Ultimately, the Lord going through the devotees of the Lord. So here we see that the devotees are glorified, and they become the cause of the wives of the brahmanas developing their bhakti. And the husbands do not get that association. They do not talk to the flower ladies and the garland makers and all these people. They're considering themselves superior. They let their wives do all that. But the wives had the very good fortune of developing bhakti by that process, because those flower sellers were also, even though they looked like they were low-class people or something, they were devotees. And so the wives of the brahmanas developed devotion by that. So in this way, we have to trace out the real cause of bhakti, and that means it is the devotees of the Lord. Okay.
We're reading the Bhagavatam now, and you just did. We were saying this to this Kali Yuga, and he felt on his left hand side of his body there were suspicious symptoms that he felt twitching and so forth. And then in the Krishna book, Prabhupada points out that Rukmini felt that Krishna was coming, and she was having these symptoms on the left side of the body also.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just trying to understand.
It was the opposite side. Or the same side. Same side. One is auspicious, one is inauspicious. Maybe the men and women are different. Just like when you read the hand, you read the left hand for the women and the right hand for the men. I don't know about twitching, actually. I haven't seen any particular thing on that, but it could be.
Prabhupada writes when in regard to meaning, and he says, this is auspicious.
Yeah.
He doesn't try to say anything about men or women.
Yeah.
And also, Ravana, when he was going out to fight Ravana,
maybe for women it's opposite. In any case, it was auspicious for her because that was the indication Krishna was coming in.
So then, how should we take it as a devotee? Should we? Because I mean, sometimes that's a liable to which.
Oh, well, for us, I don't think we should consider either of them. Unless we know the science perfectly. Because there's all sorts of complications in these things. There is one work by Kanar Vachana. Huh? This is one woman wrote one work, very famous for these sayings, omens basically, like a fox going across the road, except, or seeing a blue jay, or seeing the sunrise, or whatever, and it's the color of the sun, or whatever. But there's all things attached to it. I mean, you see it in the western direction, the animals, you see it in the eastern direction, you see it at different time of day, it's just, there's all sorts of different conditions attached to each thing you see. And it becomes different according to that, even if it's the same omen. So we have to see the details of it also. So when we see all these different things, we can't just be too simplistic about it.
But at the same time, I see that sometimes you feel these twitchings in the right side of the body.
Yeah.
And it seems to happen at different moments in your life.
Yeah.
And then it's hard to know. Yeah. Krishna trying to indicate to me, this is not just.
Well, you could say significant event may be happening then. Whether it's auspicious or inauspicious, you may not know, but nevertheless, some event is there. And the reason for that probably is because even though on the conscious level you don't detect what is happening, on the unconscious level or subtle level you do understand what is happening. In other words, the mind does have more capacity than we think it has, and it's not just the conscious level of thinking that and our external senses which perceive, but also the mind beyond that on a more subtle level can also perceive, like in dreams, for instance, and you have a dream of the future or whatever. So therefore, the mind does have the perception or the ability to intuit the future or glimpse at the future or whatever. And because of that, then body will react. So it is some sort of course, all the symptoms of the body are indications of something. Indications of some event. For instance, in bhakti, in pure bhakti, that is, then we have different symptoms of the body called sattvika bhavas. These are all, well, they can be due to either thing. Crying can be due to joy at seeing Krishna or separation from Krishna. But nevertheless, it's because of that intensity of emotion within that suddenly, spontaneously, things happen outside. Quivering of the body, tears, choking of the voice, fainting, etc. The 8 symptoms are there. And it's all because of internal disturbances, which you're not even aware of or not even trying to control, but because of the emotion for Krishna, and then these things suddenly appear, and you have no control over them. So because these are twitching in the body, again, is some sort of spontaneous, due to something in the body happening. We don't know what it is. But it can be, as I say, the mind is detecting something already that is going to happen, and therefore the body starts reacting to that. In any case, the inauspicious and auspicious elements generally will probably refer to protection or harm to the material body, which are material things ultimately. And the devotee takes shelter of Krishna, so then he's kind of beyond that.
But then, as a grihastha, then one has to interface with the material energy.
True.
And we do all the astrology.
That's true.
So then, to have the indication would be beneficial in the sense that you don't want to go down the wrong path.
So, in any case, we should be a little bit cautious at that point. If something wonderful happens, it doesn't matter. It's okay. it's the bad things we don't like, so be a little cautious anyway at that point. And if something good happens, there's no loss.
You mentioned about Shraddha. I know Shraddha, like in Bhakti Rasamrita too.
Yeah.
But that Shraddha, there's two. In Mujjayi Kadamba, he says there's Paribhagita and Swabhagita. It's meaning like Shraddha of devotees. That the person, before they come to the devotees, they are impelled by something. Either they're impelled by their own desire to clean their act or benefit themselves, and therefore they come to the devotees, Swabhavika, or Paribhavika. Somebody says, "Wow, your life is a mess. Let me help you out." And they grab you by the hand and they bring you to the devotees, like this. Like. So when you say Adho Shraddha, that it means there's a preliminary Shraddha that they have Shraddha in devotees. I trust them for something. It's like before you hear the devotees and hear about Krishna from the devotees.
There's some favorability within the Atma for Krishna. For Krishna. Agyata Sukriti.
Agyata
Sukriti.
Agyata Sukriti.
Yeah. Which means due to that's being exposed to bhakti. No. Agyata Sukriti is bhakti. You're exposed to bhakti in previous lifetimes. Accidentally or so-called accidentally by association with devotees, etc.
That's agyata sukriti.
Yes.
It's like a samskara that you had from previous
devotional samskaras. Devotional samskaras, which we didn't do anything to get. It just happened to us. Like we saw the Rath Yatra go by. We looked at Jagannath one lifetime without even going out of the house or something, Or we got some prasadam and someone gave it to us because we're hungry and we ate it. We didn't know it was prasadam.
Uh-huh.
So that's a samskara, and it creates an impression on the atma, on bhakti.
Which fructifies in another way.
After many, many piled up agyata sukritis, then it becomes shraddha.
Oh, when you accumulate agyata sukriti, when agyata sukriti is accumulated.
Yeah.
Cumulative effect.
And it may take a long time, many lifetimes.
It may take a long time for shraddha to build.
Yeah, definitely.
For that shraddha, you mean svabhavika or paribhavika shraddha?
Either way.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if somebody tells you to go see the world, you won't go if you don't have any inherent favorability towards it. Huh? You may be hostile.
Huh. Yeah.
Just like the people who have faith in the Lord, they may be full of desires and wanting to get out of their pain, so they go to the Lord. But other people won't go to the Lord in spite of having all the pains and problems. Go in the opposite direction.
Because they didn't have any secretions.
Yeah, nothing. Yeah.
They didn't have any previous stock of secretions.
Nothing. No impressions at all. Maybe the opposite.
They had no punya karma now.
Yeah, that punya karma na kamini agata sukritis.
That punya karma na in that shloka means agata sukritis.
Can, that's one interpretation.
It can.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And of course, the best punya is bhakti. Because it's also punya, but of course it's superior to all the others because it gives more results.
But there was a statement like sometimes when devotees were asking Prabhupada about this, whether some devotees were devotees in previous lives or something. Prabhupada sometimes left. You have no piety. I just created it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in some cases, we have what is the Kripasiddha devotee. With no background, he can develop bhakti because of the power of the devotee himself. That's also possible. And he can start, he can go to one level, or they're very powerful devotees. They can go from zero all the way up to Bhava or Prema. Even.
You mean like by the mercy of Uttamadikari Vaishnava? You mean?
Yeah.
That even if somebody had no sukriti at all.
Yeah.
Then simply by the desire of that Uttamadikari Bhakta to give that, that Krishna agrees and gives that sukriti to that person.
They got
even
kripa.
Even though they had no previous
Like Mrigari the hunter. He got bhava in 3 months or something.
He had no qualification. The qualification was the mercy of Narada.
Yeah. That's an example of Kripa Siddhi. 3 months.
Huh?
Kripa Siddhi. Yeah. No qualification. He got up to bhava. Very quickly.
Just by the mercy of Narada.
Yeah. And chanting the holy name, of course.
I think the danger that you're talking about is becoming the Brahman, becoming puffed up. Is that also a danger for the bhakti?
Or for devotees also?
Yeah.
That can happen in any process, obviously. Of course, I think in the Madhura Kadamani that Vishnu Chakravarti mentions, the neophyte devotees, sometimes they have utsaha.
Utsamahi.
Yeah, which is like enthusiasm, but it's really they become proud, more or less proud of their being a devotee. I'm a devotee, nobody else is a devotee, and they were very enthusiastic about that. But actually, they're only beginning the process, but then they think we're so much superior to everybody else, so they have that type of maybe egoistic pride or something in being special. Well, of course it is special, but at the same time we should realize that there's different levels of bhakti also, and the beginning levels are not that certain. In fact, we have komala sraddha, it is very tender, and you could change and become a non-devotee very quickly also. Only when we reach nishta and the madhyam level, then we have more or less fixed, and that requires some work also. So we have overconfidence, so to speak, sometimes in our position. So we should never really feel like that, because actually we should understand the nature of the material world. Even if you're on bhava, you can fall down. So one should never be overconfident.
You mentioned that for bhakti there's no necessity of self-good.
Yeah. To begin the process. Yeah. But of course, by performing bhakti, we surpass all the gunas, and that means, and of all the gunas, sattva guna is the most favorable. So generally, in our practices, we will adopt, as far as relating to the material world is concerned, we'll follow sattvic processes, as far like samskaras in the society, rules for marriage will come from varnashram system in a sattvic way, etc. And relating to the body and the material, cleanliness, sattvic. So we follow rules of cleanliness, which are taken from the varnashram system, brahminical rules of cleanliness. We'll take all these things from sattvagun, relating to the body. But we should not think that therefore sattva guna is a cause of bhakti. It's automatically manifested with the development of bhakti. As the gunas are destroyed, the rajaguna and tamaguna are destroyed, and even sattva guna is destroyed because of risuddha sattva. But of the three, sattva guna is preferable, and that's why he praises it in Bhagavad Gita in the later chapters. Sattva guna is better than raja and tama. And in, of course, the Nectar of Devotion that Rupa Goswami says, developing good qualities is not an anga of bhakti, but shadguna is what we call subhada. That is a characteristic of bhakti that one automatically develops all good qualities anyway by the process of bhakti. And all of the bad things are destroyed. Klesha Agni takes place. All the anartas and karmas, etc., ignorance are all destroyed by bhakti, and all the good things appear automatically. So therefore, if a devotee shows bad qualities, well, of course, we understand a devotee should develop all good qualities, and then if he shows bad qualities, then we have to understand that two things. One is, previous bad qualities are still present, or somehow due to bad practice of bhakti, some bad qualities are new ones are appearing, or old ones are not getting destroyed. Nevertheless, we should understand that with the process of bhakti, if done properly, all these things will be destroyed. And therefore, we don't unnecessarily dwell on the bad qualities. We try to see the good quality that he's performing bhakti. But where it becomes very prominent and serious, then one has to take notice of it, because it can mean that one is not practicing bhakti properly, and therefore it grows and becomes a big anarta, and it will destroy bhakti.